ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves. We stood tall and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
It's 1914, the eve of the First World War, and to the west of the German Empire, just outside modern-day Bonn, workmen are digging up slate. They're having a pretty normal day, until...
They found remains of humans, and they thought that they had discovered people that had been murdered. They called for the local teacher from the school who came, and he had read about archaeology, and he said, oh no, they look very old, these bones.
So they sent a letter off to the museum, and eventually an archaeologist turned up to investigate these old bones that could very well be a part of an ancient murder mystery.
And then he looked at these remains and said, oh, these are really very old remains.
So old, they might have been called subfossils. Not yet bones turned to stone, but bones on the way to stones.
And they dug out all the area and they found more remains from the humans and also artifacts that were buried with them and also this dog.
A dog skeleton. Laid out next to two humans. What sort of effed up murder was this?
The skeletons are almost fully preserved and they were covered with red ochre, which is a color that was used in archaeological settings, certainly when people died.
They didn't know it yet, but those workers had uncovered the oldest dog remains ever found at the time.
Now, with modern methodology, we know that they were about 14,500 years old.
Which is about 72,514 dog years.
It has been the oldest dog ever found.
Initially, experts thought that it was a wolf, and then later confirmed that it was indeed a dog. And there were a few big hints the archaeologists put together about ancient dogs like this one.
If we look at all these dogs, these very old dogs that we have, these 15 or so skeletons, they're all the same typology. So they're all about 14 kilograms of weight and they're all about 40 centimeters, 45 centimeters high at the shoulder.
Whereas wolves are sometimes like 50 to 80 kilograms, about 80 centimetres tall to the shoulder, they're way bigger.
The second thing that we know is that these remains have genes that code for coat colour. And we find totally different genes compared to the ones in wolves. So there was already white, there was already black dogs.
This was really a domesticated dog, Canis familiaris. And because the bones were also covered in red ochre, archaeologists concluded that it was intentionally buried with this human couple. It was meaningful enough to be buried with humans.
When I started my university studies, I wanted...
Luke Jansons, the owner of The Voice that you're hearing down the line, he's an archaeologist who used to be a veterinary orthopaedic surgeon. Now, that is a pretty unique set of qualifications. And it meant that when he went to look at these bones, he noticed a whole heap of things that were previously missed.
We could define exactly how old the dog was, 6.5 months.
And Luke looked at its teeth.
And so when I was going over these teeth in detail, I found that there was a very specific abnormality which is seen in modern dogs when they have Carré disease, which is distemper. It had actually had three periods of being very sick during the period it was living with these humans, and they must have taken quite some care to get it through these periods, otherwise it probably would have died, because if modern dogs nowadays get distemper, 99% or so of them die.
This was one sick, ancient puppy. A dog that absolutely would have died without human care. So why would these humans keep a sick puppy around? Why would they bury it next to humans as if it was part of a human family?
Within the archaeological world and the anthropology world, there's always the question, why at one point did humans decide to keep wolves and then form them into dogs? There is always the trend to base it on utility for hunting as a guard, things like that. And of course, in this case, we could say, no, it's impossible that this dog could have done that. First of all, it was much too young to be any help for hunting. And secondly, it was sick most of the time. So it must have been very emotional.
They were buried with a pet, an animal that they loved. This is the first evidence we have of this homely sort of emotional attachment between humans and dogs. Domestication just got the feels. I'm not crying, you are. So, for tens of thousands of years, humans and dogs have not just been colleagues, but friends. But how did they become our companions? Did we collar them, or did they tame us? On ABC Radio National, I'm Dr. Anne Jones, and on What the Duck this season, we're giving dogs a big wet kiss and looking in depth at the way our destinies are intertwined. How did we get pugs out of wolves? How did the howling creatures of our nightmares become the floppy-eared, tail-wagging good boys and girls who really aren't meant to be up on the bed? Get down! Is that dog really smiling at me? Dogs sense magnetic fields. What does our shared future hold? This is Dogs, Chapter 1, From Wolf to Wolf. How did we get to this cuddle puddle of the afterlife near Bonn, where those two people and that dog were buried together, covered in ochre? Where did dogs come from?
Every domestic animal that you can think of is descended from a single population of a wild species, and then through its association with people has been transported everywhere.
Gregor Larson is a professor of evolutionary genomics at the University of Oxford.
Every dog ever is descended from a Eurasian population of grey wolves.
Eurasia is a big place though, so can we narrow that down to doggy ground zero?
If I said anything that was less than... Paris to Japan, that's the confidence intervals, right? It's big.
Okay, so no, then Gregor doesn't want to be pinned down to doggy ground zero.
Our suspicion is still that it's looking like a more of a northern thing, probably more of an eastern thing.
Right, so we're talking Russia, China, Mongolia, that sort of area. That is where Lassie originated. Maybe.
But we're not ruling anything out. And it also seems to be that once people have dogs, it appears that they're moving pretty quickly. And that also kind of confounds the issue.
Yeah, because migration means mixing genetics. Because inevitably, right, migrants get busy with the locals when they get to a new place.
Problem with that, of course, is then it starts to completely confuse the genomes, makes it very hard to analyze, and makes it hard for us to distinguish whether dogs may or may not have been derived from two populations of wolves or one population and then movement with gene flow. So one thing that we can say for certain, that dogs are derived from gray wolves. What the ancient DNA has demonstrated this very, very convincingly is that you have a whole bunch of variability in gray wolves, wild wolves throughout Eurasia, and that dogs are descended from the Eurasian gray wolf.
Okay, so the where is a bit hazy, but what about the when?
The paper that we did fairly recently suggesting dog domestication might have happened in Siberia around, 20 to 23,000 years ago.
That's Dr. Angela Perry, a zoo archaeologist who studies early human-animal interactions. And she's more willing to call where it all started as Siberia, and also says that during the last ice age, the tough conditions likely pushed wolves and humans into closer proximity.
We know that the kind of northern latitudes, particularly in Eurasia, were not a particularly nice place to live. You would have a quite extreme climate, extreme cold, fairly barren landscape with vegetation, and because of the vegetation being barren, animals as well. We know that across the world during this time period, we had various kind of refugia where both humans and animals taking refuge to, quote unquote, wait it out. We're talking about thousands of years of nasty climate that you're waiting out, though.
So wolves and humans waited it out in refuges from the last ice age. It's sort of like a COVID relationship. The isolation just makes you do funny things. But it still doesn't really answer the question, how? How did it happen? Did wolves turn themselves into dogs by relying on human scraps? Or did humans invent dogs by stealing baby wolves?
The theory that's kind of prevailing at any one time fluctuates. And I think we're probably more these days in the camp of domestication was unintentional on both sides. Approaching domestication is always tricky because we have always known domestication in our lives. We're surrounded by domesticated animals and plants. And it's so natural to us to understand having domesticates in our life that it's hard for us to think about being a hunter-gatherer, you know, like 20,000 years ago, and not understanding the concept of domestication. You know, dogs were our first domesticate. And so there's no model for that. We didn't look at wolves and say, hey, if we take these things, we hang out with them long enough, we could probably force them into like a couch potato. I think it's likely that's much more unintentional.
Yeah, ancient humans didn't have foresight like that. They hadn't even domesticated grains yet. And wolves were big, scary predators. Our ancestors would have been shook. And we still are shook, to be fair. That Liam Neeson movie haunts my dreams. Though I will take that over the disappointment I felt after that Kevin Costner movie that I thought was about a canine ballet company. Anyway, animal behavioralist Dr. Clive Wynne reckons it's unlikely that we just thought, yeah, I'll make that chomping, growling pack of fluff monsters work for me.
No, I think we flatter ourselves when we imagine that we invented dogs. Wouldn't it have been an amazing thing for our ancestors to have pulled off, to have invented these, you know, indispensable partners and loving companions and useful tools? But no, I really don't think that's at all likely.
Bummer.
I think that dogs invented themselves. A certain group of wolves, maybe 20,000 years ago, deep in the last ice age, they figured out it could be an easier life, maybe, to hang around the humans and take what the humans couldn't eat. And that's the beginning of a long, beautiful partnership. I mean, they didn't have any domesticated plants either. So our ancestors couldn't possibly have had, the thought could never have entered a person's life that if I just put up with this rambunctious, difficult wolf cub, and if I keep doing this for a few hundred generations, in the end, I'll have something useful that will curl up with me in bed, right? That thought could never have crossed their mind because they'd never seen a domesticated anything. Aside from the whole, you know, the whole possibility of people planning for things that would have taken generations to have reached the point that would actually be useful. Before your pet wolf turns into a dog, how many of your babies is it going to have eaten? That's the kind of thing you need to think about here.
Domestication and speciation doesn't just happen one day. Presto, wolf, now dog. It's a long process, it's not a flip switch. You'd have many generations of some in-betweener wolf dogs, some wolgs or some dolves, before you could actually say, yes, that is a modern dog. And even then, it's all a bit murky.
So how is it we have a static framework on top of a very dynamic world, and yet we expect it to make sense? And of course it doesn't, right? Of course it doesn't.
Gregor Larson, railing against the modern human need to label things.
So you're getting wolves plus people over a period of time equaling dogs. And then at some point we say, oh, now that deserves a different title. So instead of Canis lupus for wolf, we call it Canis familiaris for dog. Does that mean anything biologically? Absolutely not. Are dogs and wolves able to mate and create fertile offspring? Absolutely. They can all interbreed and create fertile offspring and do routinely.
Okay, Rover, you dog, you.
This is the big revelation over the last 10 or 15 years within evolutionary biology mixed with genetics. and the ability to sequence genomes much more readily than we ever could in the past, is this recognition that there is a lot of gene flow between things that we would not expect to have gene flow. Here's a surprise. Everything's having sex all the time, and a lot of it makes it into genomes. That's just how biology and life works. So for us to then go in and go, okay, you are Canis lupus, you are Canis familiaris, and therefore we're expecting that to mean something on a biological or evolutionary level, is more, we're getting frustrated because biology is violating the rules that we're demanding of it.
Wait, so if they'd just been occasionally barking up the wrong tree over the last 30,000 years or so, are they even different? I mean, how similar are dogs to wolves in the genetic sense?
Very similar. 99%+.
That's Dr. Angela Perry again. In fact, researchers in 2016 identified just 11 genes that they surmised were the only functional differences between modern wolves and modern domestic dogs. And most of these, they wrote, controlled aggressiveness.
We know that canids really love to interbreed. And what's not great for us genetically or archaeologically is that it's not only likely, but we can tell from the genetics that domesticated dogs were continuously and are continuously breeding again with wild wolf populations.
And sometimes that rebreeding was intentionally done by humans. Well, not done by humans. It was facilitated by humans.
You know, I have a really great example of working in Kazakhstan. And in Kazakhstan, they use dogs and eagles and horses all together to hunt wolves. They have a really big population of wolves in Kazakhstan. And I was at this very small regional museum there, and I saw this picture of an eagle hunter with his horse and his dogs, and he caught like two wolf cubs. And I said to the Kazakh hunter I was with, you know, why are the wolves alive, or what are they going to do with them? They said, oh, sometimes they keep the wolves, but also they intentionally leave their female dogs outside tied up to a tent in the hopes that one of these wild wolves will mate with their dog and then produce, you know, a bigger, stronger, more wolf-resistant dog. And as someone who studies genetics and trying to use genetics to get closer to dog domestication, that was actually devastating to me, because I realized that this goal of, you know, getting to these pure genetics of understanding dog domestication, there's just constant dilution of the genetics of dogs with wolf integration.
You know, it's like dogs are disappearing before my ears.
Wolves are constantly breeding with dogs. Dogs are constantly breeding with wolves. And they're so closely related that that's just not even a problem. And they can't help themselves. They desire to interbreed with each other.
Interspecies romance. It's all doggy style. This is What the Duck. I'm Anne Jones, and we are going deep down the hole that Roger the dog dug in the backyard to the very, very start of our mateship with dogs. So hanging out in Ice Age refugia, humans and dogs slowly became more friendly. And when the ice melted, humans moved and their dog pals moved with them.
We know from the human genetics that they move in multiple directions. They move back down into, you know, the rest of Eurasia, but they also move across the Bering Land Bridge into the Americas for the very first time as humans. And the genetic results from dogs suggests that along with humans moving, that dogs moved with them in all directions.
And what we can say is that we know that we've got people and dogs coming into North America at about 15, 16,000 years ago.
Gregor Larson, the expert in ancient doggy DNA.
But it is curious that the time frame of when we're seeing this diversification of dogs and the diversification of people as they're entering the new world is virtually identical chronologically. And that seems to suggest that the two of them are coming at the same time.
Not just at the same time, together.
And they seem to be getting into the Americas pretty quickly with those dogs.
And not just together, but relying on each other. Because ancient dogs weren't just tagging along and mooching off our scraps.
So we suspect that those dogs were probably both hunting and sledging dogs.
Sledding dogs. The dogs themselves probably facilitated the rapid expansion of modern humans through the Americas and, in fact, over much of the world.
And not only that, but because that whole region is going to be relatively similar ecologically, what's to stop you from going from Alaska all the way to Denmark, right? Or even further, and all the way up into Scandinavia. So it's possible that dogs were really facilitating a very rapid movement of people and therefore of the dogs themselves, which therefore makes it even harder to pinpoint where they're coming from in the first place because suddenly they're everywhere.
Together, dogs and humans took over the world. And over the years, as humans moved and established agriculture and settlements, the dogs continued to prove themselves useful for all sorts of jobs. Angela Perry.
I feel like dogs are a Swiss Army knife of things because they just serve so many roles.
They were and are things that you already know about, guarders and herders, hunters and sled dogs.
But also they're a babysitter. They're a warning and alarm system. They are a cleanup system when you live in a camp or village and it's quite messy with things like feces of other animals or humans.
You know when your dog eats poop? Coprophagia, where they just seem compelled to eat shit? Yeah, well, we might have intentionally selected for that.
They're an emergency food source. Quite useful for that. An emergency fur source. Quite useful for that.
Zoo archaeologists have found sites across the ancient Mediterranean and Near East which have evidence of dogs doing all of these things. Guards, companions, hunting aids, and also bones with butchery marks, which indicate that dogs were eaten. And there's even a specific word for the practice of eating dogs, cynophagy. And of course, humans have used dogs to do what humans do, that is, oppress other humans.
The Spaniards in particular were quite famous for their dogs of war and bringing dogs with them to the Americas and using them as tools to scare people and keep people in line.
On Columbus's second voyage, they brought dogs with them, big ones, mastiffs and greyhounds, indicating that perhaps they knew that coercion was going to be necessary to control the local indigenous populations. And before that, in the Bronze Age, on what is now the Russian steppes, male dogs were sacrificed by war bands as initiation before combat. Doing so apparently channeled a human transformation to an all-powerful, unbeatable, savage male canid, which is useful stuff before going into battle. And it's just wild when you put this in context, how many different ways we have used dogs. We use them like they're multi-tools. With every era, we've bred and altered dogs to take on new roles. It turns out they're one of the most adaptive technologies we have.
Hearing dogs, medical dogs now, cancer detection dogs, all these amazing things that dogs can do because of their unique kind of superhuman abilities. And that we as humans have figured out that, hey, we can use a dog to do all these things for us as technology. And I think, you know, they are really the start of the biotechnology revolution, because how amazing that we figured out we can use another animal to do things for us.
So without them, what would we be? Where would we be? I mean, I would call this a sliding door moment, but I've seen too many dogs walk directly into them. And moreover, where would dogs be? Today, there's one dog for every 8 people on Earth.
The best guess, about 1 billion dogs alive today on planet Earth.
Clive Wynn.
Which is a very big number. I think I'm right in saying that they are the most numerous large mammal, because of course mice and little things, the most numerous large mammal that is not kept for agriculture. Let's say 1 billion. Then how many of those are pets? We're guessing, but about a quarter of the total, probably. 250 million, maybe 300 million.
Just a quarter of all of the Earth's current day dogs are pets. That means 3/4 are free living, almost exclusively in and around human settlement.
What I find fascinating looking at it in the historical site is how human society has changed so much over the last 12,000 years since the end of the Ice Age. You got the ancient Egyptians, you got Aztecs, you got medieval people in Europe, and all the way along, as human life has changed in so many ways, dogs have always found new ways to be helpful.
The most recent innovation is to be tiny and shaky and have puppuccinos and a billion likes on TikTok. But the underlying utility in all that? Dogs are providing humans with joy. They're being useful. You have just listened to Dogs, Chapter 1, From Woof to Woof. Next time...
And we have the third prize goes to 335 from Huston Secretary Thomas. You've won $30 in cash. Thank you.
You breed, for the betterment of the breed, you want good purebred Papillons. We would like perfect Papillons. So the thing is, you're trying to breed perfection, which will never happen, but you try...
Where did the quest for perfection in pets come from? On ABC Radio National, this episode of What the Duck was produced by me, Dogter Anne Jones, Nat Tenchich and Rebecca McLaren. It's made on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and Jarwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, as well as the Wadawurrung people.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.